this episode, Once Upon a Military Science Fiction Novel. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we're finding our joy discussing a particular niche within the science fiction novel, specifically the genre of military science fiction novels. My name is Iridiamal Shag, and I am your host, but this is not a solo mission, folks. For this episode, I am joined by an old buddy of mine and a fellow podcaster. I met this gentleman, and to be honest, I use the term loosely, gentlemen. I met him as a comic book trivia host at Dragon Con over 15 years ago, probably even longer, honestly. I don't remember how far back. But more relevant to today's topic, he's an author of fantasy, superhero, and science fiction novels, having written something like 60 books. And he's got his own military sci-fi book about to be published after a very successful Kickstarter. So folks, please help me welcome to the show, Mr. Van Allen Plexico. How you doing, Van?
Hey, Shag. It's so good to talk to you again, and I'm really excited to be on your show. This is a cool topic, too, so let's have some fun with it.
I'm really excited, because what spawned this was there was a poll that came out recently by one of these little sci-fi websites saying, you know, what's the top military sci-fi books of all time? And I've been reading a lot of military sci-fi books lately, and I just wouldn't shut up about it around the house. And like I'm telling my wife, I'm like, oh, one more thing, and one more thing. And clearly she had had enough. And so she's like, you should do like a podcast on that or something. And clearly that was just her way of saying, get that out of your system. I don't want to hear about it anymore. And once she said that, I'm like, oh, Van just did the, you know, the Kickstarter for Alpha Omega. This is perfect. And you were, you know, foolish enough to say yes, to be honest. So thank you so much.
No, this is great. It's exciting. It's certainly one of my several of my favorite genres and subgenres, and I'm really excited to talk about it for sure.
I didn't even know that I was so into it. I'll talk about a particular book in a bit, but I picked one up a couple years ago and I read it and I just loved it. And from then on, I just seemed to be gravitating towards these, you know, military sci-fi books. And if any of you follow me on Facebook or social Twitter or whatever, you probably see me posting pictures of me with these books. And honestly, I slip my feet in the picture. You probably noticed by now, because no one ever comments on the book. They only ever comment on the feet. So that's why I always do that. But it's just my way of sharing the love of these sci-fi books.
Yeah, I did see that poll you referred to about the top military sci-fi books. And, you know, it's interesting. Military sci-fi is the kind of thing that it's hard to define often. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like it would be blatantly obvious what it is. Yet everybody seems to disagree on exactly what it is. If any science fiction story has the military in it at some point, people want to include it as military sci-fi. And the thing is that a whole lot of sci-fi has some military stuff in it, right? It's hard to find sci-fi that doesn't have some kind of military something in it. And so, you know, it's not surprising that there were books on that list that I was like, even know if that qualifies. And of course, the other thing with polls like that is they always skew more recent, right? Because people have read stuff that just came out. You know, probably, you know, a lot of readers are not as ancient as me, and they're not gonna, so they haven't read stuff that maybe came out in the 60s or 70s, you know, or even the 80s when it was really roaring along there. So, you know, it didn't surprise me, but I was not super fond of that list. But I don't honestly know that, you know, of contemporary things right now, I'm not sure what I would put in there instead. It's tough. So I'm looking forward to this conversation, because we can dig around into some stuff that we think is military sci-fi. Maybe, you know, talk about whether we agree or not.
Right. I was one of those people who thought it was cookie cutter until I started reading some of your notes you'd put together here for us to talk about. I'm like, wow, this is rather complicated to identify what's what. All right, so, you know, why don't we get into this? So why don't we talk about, just to kick us off here, again, military science fiction. What was your first book in that genre that you remember reading? Or if not the first, what was the one that was influential that made you fall in love with the genre? I'm curious to hear that.
Well, here's the thing. Back in the, like, you know, mid to late 70s, early 80s, when I first started reading, you know, whatever paperbacks were on the shelves at, I guess back then it was B. Dalton or whatever.
Sure.
When I would go in Birmingham, Alabama, it was whatever really attracted my attention, usually with a good cover, and then eventually later the author, right? Mm-hmm. And the ones that really first caught my attention in the late 70s, early 80s were probably David Drake, right? I mean, David Drake was kind of the godfather of contemporary contemporary American military sci-fi, and Hammer Slammers and Ranks of Bronze and all that, you know, all that stuff. But the thing was, I bought two or three of those back then and just did not dig the writing. I just didn't get into the stories. It was like cool cover, cool concepts, but I just couldn't get into it. And so I always thought of military sci-fi as something I enjoyed on TV or in movies, you know, and probably a good example would be like the second Aliens, you know, Alien movie, mm-hmm. which is very much a military sci-fi movie. Yeah. And compared to the first one is a horror movie. The second one's a military sci-fi movie. But so I liked it in movies and TV, but I had a hard time finding books that really pulled me in and made me enjoy them as much as I felt like I should. And I guess what really got me going was when I discovered the British version. And then there's some American stuff that kind of plays off the British version. And I'll introduce this idea, and we can elaborate on it, expand on it as we go along here. Right. But one of my ideas is that I think there's an American school of military sci-fi and a British school of military sci-fi, and they're very different. And in brief, and I'll go along this more as we go, the American school is a little more shiny, modern, individualistic, got more of kind of like a Jack Reacher feel to it in sci-fi. And the British version is a little more Harry Potter in space. It's a little more fantasy, a little more monsters and demons and gothic and stuff. And Warhammer 40,000 always, you know, kind of comes up in that idea. We'll talk more about this. But when I discovered that British side, it just has a lot more color to it, a lot more depth, and it grabbed me in ways that the American school just never has. So
I am fascinated to get into this conversation because, like, for me, I didn't even know there were these kind of two different schools of thought. Like, in looking at my selections and what I picked and what I've been reading, I guess I've really, and I realize this is your theory, it's not like it's out there, but I've never really been exposed to anything beyond kind of the American school of military sci-fi. Like, you know, the hoorah kind of version, as I would say.
Right.
You know, And now, like, my two of my biggest fandoms, because we all have our little clicks of what we love, but like Doctor Who is probably my biggest fandom of everything, right? And in that, it's the British gentleman can solve anything, you know, like you said. And the Blake 7 is another one, which is completely different. It's where the heroes are fighting a losing battle against tyranny, and the heroes become so obsessed they go crazy, and they usually end up dead. So I like British sci-fi is in my DNA. So I got to imagine that like connecting with this British sci-fi stuff is really something I'm looking forward to now. I went into this conversation thinking I knew a little bit, but I realized I am like the kindergartner in the sci-fi reading world, and you're the college professor who's here to educate me, and I am all about that. So thank you.
Well, we'll see.
Well, my first book I'm going to mention is going to demonstrate how pedestrian I am. For me, the thing that probably got me most interested in military sci-fi, and I didn't even think of it as a genre unto itself, you know, until a couple years ago, but was probably the Star Wars X-Wing novels by Michael Stackpole. And really, that's a cheat because those are TV movie tie-ins, really. I mean, it's its own category, right? Or you could look at it and say, okay, maybe it's half military sci-fi, but the other half's, you know, space fantasy. There's laser swords and stuff running around. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's two-thirds military. I don't know. But anyway, I just really, really enjoyed when those, like when they came out and I had just finished working at a comic book store and I had stacked, half the store was used books. So I was constantly stocking all these old sci-fi books from the 60s and 70s, probably the ones you're talking about. And all the covers look great. I never read any of them, though. They look fascinating to me. So here was one that I felt like I could dig into because I already knew Star Wars. And I became obsessed with these X-Wing books. I read, you know, blazed through them. I love the Stackpole books especially. And one thing I loved about it was every time he described a mission or specifically a space battle, I could follow the space battle. When he's talking about, you know, ships going left and right and banking and dogfighting, like I could follow the battle in my head. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. Even reread them a couple years ago, and I thought they still held up. So again, that's a cheat. So I really don't feel like that counts, but that's really where the passion starts for me. The one where you could say I kind of awoke to this was The Forever War by Joe Haldeman. I'd been a member of the Science Fiction Book Club, you know, that one where you sign up for the club and you get 10 books and blah, 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 that sort of thing. Like the Columbia Record House tape club or something. And it always topped, you know, the top of the science fiction must read list. I'm like, well, I've never read it. And it's, you know, kind of said it had sort of a time travel angle to it, kind of. So I finally read it probably about 15 years ago, and it blew me away, right? That's when I really felt like I was making a connection to military sci-fi. And I pulled out, getting ready for this episode, I pulled out my copy off the shelf, and I looked at it, and it has a foreword in it by John Scalzi, who you're going to hear a lot more about John Scalzi from me as we get going here today. But it blew me, I had no idea John Scalzi was connected to that, and I've only recently became a fan of his, so... Mm-hmm. All cyclical.
I just want to say, in response to your the way that you evaluated yourself, I don't think you should gatekeep yourself. I feel like it all is very muddy, right? And if sure. if you enjoy, there are certainly military sci-fi aspects of Star Wars, just like there are of anything like any of, like I said, all the TV shows that are in the military sci-fi track at Dragon Con, then that's what you enjoy. And it's, I think that's fair. It doesn't have to be pure, right? It doesn't have to be nothing but military shenanigans to qualify. I mean, that's. Books just spread around, muddle into each other's genres all the time. So nothing's really pure anymore, really. And that's fine. That's a good thing.
And that's fair. And I'm not, you know, I'm not like embarrassed by what I like, because, you know, I like what I like, and that's all there is to it, you know, and that's fine. And some of the books I read are totally schlocky, and I'm okay with that. You know, they're probably the military sci-fi equivalent of the Harlequin romance novel. Who knows? But, well, before we get too deep into this, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors, folks. This episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we pick a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and it's usually tied into the discussion in some way, shape, or form. And I picked Alien Legion Dead and Buried Omnibus Trade Paperback. Now, this is from Titan Comics, and it's reprinting the old Marvel Alien Legion comics. Specifically, this is Volume 2, Issues 1 through 12. I've never read Volume 2. I've read Volume 1, and it blew me away. In Volume 2 here, written by Chuck Dixon with art by Randy Emmerlin and Larry Stroman. I mean, come on. Yes, please. More of that. And if you don't know it, it's basically the French Foreign Legion out in space with aliens. A lot of great, you know, early 80s sci-fi. Feels a little 2000 AD, a little crazy. Love this stuff. Page count for this collection is 368 pages. It's full color and it's a soft cover. Normally goes for $29.99, but you can get it 25% off. So it's only $22.49. And if you like sci-fi comics and you like military sci-fi, I can't recommend Alien Legion enough for you. Now, Van, did you happen to bring a selection by chance?
Well, I'm going to say Alien Legion definitely qualifies. That's probably the most military sci-fi thing that I've ever seen in comics. I mean, it doesn't get any more military sci-fi than Alien Legion in comics.
There we go. Awesome.
Yeah, I dug around a little bit on that website after you mentioned it and saw that one of my favorite collections of graphic novel type things is Darwin Cook's adaptations of Richard Stark's Parker. These are the crime novels that people, when you say Richard Stark's Parker, people don't know what you're talking about usually. But if you say, well, it was adapted into Mel Gibson's Payback and Lee Marvin's Point Blank and Jason Statham's Parker.
Wow.
All of those are adaptations of basically the same couple of books in that series. Well, they were never really, if you think about those three movies, they're not very similar, except having a criminal, you know, who's the main character. But Darwin Cook adapted the books. He adapted like five or six of the books before he passed away, tragically. And they are spectacular. I mean, they have, I saw that InStock Trades has the two giant, I mean, I have these. They are gigantic, like coffee table size books, two Ooh. Inches thick, two nice. Volumes. And they reproduce probably the size that he drew the original pages. And they're done in like a single color wash. Each story in those two volumes is a different color wash to fit the mood of that story. And so you get like five or six, seven of the novels adapted into amazing comic book form. And he was going to do more before he passed away. I was so sad he passed away, and I was so sad he didn't get to finish doing all the, you know, the ones he wanted to do. But they're at a really good price on InStock Trades. I would run, don't walk, and get those.
Those sound fantastic. I was not even aware of the Parker book's existence or his adaptations until very recently. I saw somebody posted on Facebook just in the last, it might have even been you, I'm not sure, in just the last few months about it. And some of the art looked amazing. I mean, it's Darwin Cook, you know, I don't need to say that his artwork's amazing. That's redundant. But, it looked fantastic. And if you're into the crime genre, that sounds awesome. Very cool.
Yeah, his style fits that type of story so well. Absolutely.
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah. Well, folks, for these and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows on our network, the best way to support us is by visiting our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And in certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to Michael Salko, David Ace Gutierrez, and Gord Tolton. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com. patreon.com/FW podcasts. All right, people, this is where you get involved. Whether you're a newbie like me and you just like Star Wars, or whether you're hardcore and you already know all the British stuff, whatever it might be, get on the social media and tell us what you like about science fiction, military, sci-fi novels. You know, are you a Robert Heinlein reader? Are you a John Scalzi reader? Do you like something else? The best way to be part of the conversation is in the comments section on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts there on the show post, and they will get read on a future episode of this show. You can also find us over on Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. And again, we want to hear from you, share your thoughts, and I will read your thoughts on every fifth episode of this podcast. This is the 21st episode, so you got some time to get your thoughts in. But please do that. Go out and visit and leave your comment on our website. All right, now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to get into what the hell exactly is military sci-fi books.
Hello, I'm Anthony.
And I'm Dr. Issues.
And we're the hosts of Capes on the Couch, the podcast where comics get counseling.
Superheroes don't always get to go home happy. That's where we come in.
We offer psychiatric and mental health evaluation of comic book characters.
We also chat with some of your favorite creators.
Al Ewing.
Erica Schultz.
Gail Simone.
Philip Kennedy Johnson.
Chris Claremont.
About their work on comics.
So check out all our episodes at capesonthecouch.com and follow us at Capes on the Couch on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Hashtag because comics.
It's the year 1992, and the Justice Society of America, the world's first superhero team, make a triumphant return after 6 years trapped in another dimension. Finally home, the JSA find themselves relics in a world that has moved on. It's the age of pulse-pounding action, where the rules of fair play are tossed aside for gritty violence. Our heroes ask themselves, does the world still need a Justice Society? Oh, yes, it does. Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for JSA in the 90s. We'll delve into the 10-issue Justice Society of America ongoing series, drawn by the iconic Mike Parabek. We'll explore the 8-issue retroactive miniseries and unearth hidden gems from the era. Join us for JSA in the 90s, available as part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, beginning in August 2024. All right, Van, I got to ask you, why do you enjoy the sci-fi military genre? And I think that's going to also lead to what the heck is the sci-fi military genre? What's that actually mean? So take us to school, sir.
Well, I mean, first, you know, if you want me to answer that question about why do I just enjoy the genre, I think that what we enjoy in some action type stories is people, the good guys, the protagonists, figuring things out in an organized and professional manner and then addressing the situation. And the military is a particularly useful vehicle for bringing those protagonists to the situation and helping us enjoy them, right? Because they're organized, they have weapons, they're trained in their use. They're usually facing some kind of an enemy that's pretty easily defined. The villains, the aliens, the bad guys, right? I mean, I think everything about the military lends itself to the setup of a really good story. It's either, I mean, if you think about it, you know, my favorite kind of stories are either the military goes and does some kind of mission like that, or heist criminals go, you know, like Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
They're organized and have a plan too and are specialists, you know, I've written two books like that. Or, you know, or just some kind of like a Lord of the Rings fellowship of little specialists going in on a mission. I'm a big men on a mission fan, right? Like I love Alistair MacLean. He's not science fiction, but he's definitely military, and everything from like the Guns of Navarone to Force 10 from Navarone to Ice Station Zebra. You could put every one of those stories in outer space. I mean, Battlestar Galactica put those stories in outer space.
Yes.
Right? The gun on Ice Planet Zebra.
I knew BSG was going to come to the conversation here somewhere.
There you go. So, yeah, I think why we enjoy the military sci-fi genre is we get the sci-fi and we get, again, like I said, you know, as a metaphor, it provides a vehicle for getting us into the story, giving us compelling characters that know their part. They know their role. They're trained. They're, you know, and as I've always said, one thing that people tend to enjoy in any kind of story is seeing people who know what they're doing, do a good job at it, right? We love Sherlock Holmes solving a crime. We love a detective figuring out a crime. We love a superhero figuring out something and defeating the bad guy. We love seeing a professional at work. It's one of the reasons I love those Parker novels we were talking about, is that Parker's like the most professional thief, and he figures out how to rob places without getting arrested or killed. You know, it doesn't matter what the vocation. We just like seeing a professional being proficient at their job. It's just a fun, you know, it's why we like procedural stories and things too. So that's kind of why. Shall I go into the American and British schools theory that I have?
Why don't I hit up real quick, just bouncing off yours, and then we can dive into that, because that's going to be a much bigger topic, I think. So for me, and I'll keep it as brief as I can, it's hard for me to say. Like, I really had a hard time trying to figure out how to articulate, and you articulated it much better than I'm going to, but like a lot of it's just from my gut. You know, I've been a sci-fi nut my whole life, and these just grab my attention. And I'm trying to identify themes that I've seen in the books that I'm drawn to. And like the first is respect for military, right? Because I never served in the military, but I have the utmost respect for everyone that ever has. And tied to sort of that sort of is my sense of patriotism. And I feel personally that I'm a very patriotic person. And regardless of my personal feelings about whatever political landscape is happening at any given time, it doesn't change that I still feel very patriotic to the ideals of our country. And often a lot of these characters feel the same way. They're serving that same sort of idea, not necessarily the United States, but, you know, their country or their world or whatever they're part of. There's also a lot of loyalty and camaraderie. You know, a lot of these stories, there's a real sense of sticking together. The soldiers are in a squad together and they're going to, you know, everyone's got each other's back. And I have that same sort of connection with my friends. You know, it's not exactly the same, but I can relate to it at least. And a key one you've already really enumerated, which was the mission focused. You know where the story's going. It's not going to meander. They're going towards a specific goal. And as a reader, it's nice to know what you're aiming for, right? And of course, lots of action, you know, combined with cool sci-fi concepts, which is lots of fun. But I think that, for me, that ties into a lot of what you said as well. Okay, folks, so in the spirit of military sci-fi, Van and I have had to adapt and overcome a completely FUBAR situation. So due to electrical storms and the magic of the internet, we have had to rely on a tin can and string to finish this conversation. So if the audio quality is completely different and not amazing, folks, just go along with the ride. Again, you as a listener must adapt and overcome as well. All right, Van. So where we left off is I want to hear all about your crazy mad scientist theory, the difference between the American and the British schools of military sci-fi. Take us to school, sir.
All right. Well, emphasizing the idea that this is my theory, it's not something that's widely, I think it's sort of one of these things that's just understood, but never really maybe enunciated and enumerated this way. But I have extolled it on like a military sci-fi panel or two at Dragon Con in front of big time military sci-fi writers, and they nodded sagely rather than saying, "What are you talking about?" So I took that as a good sign. But my theory is there's an American school and there's a British school. And I'll lay out the American school first, and then you and of course I'd love to hear your thoughts about it. My feeling is the American school, which is probably one people are a little more acquainted with, really kind of goes back in the contemporary era, like David Drake, and then a little more recently David Weber, John Ringo for sure, and then a lot of the other Bayon writers like Tom Kratman and so forth. Bayon is a haven for the current military sci-fi crowd. They're all over Bayon. What makes that school unique is it's often written by U.S. military veterans, and David Drake and his generation were Vietnam War veterans in particular. It's heavily influenced by the U.S. experience in Vietnam. And so there's sort of a sense of, you know, it's us against the brass. The government won't let us win. We have to figure it out for ourselves. There's usually a focus on really slick, shiny new technology and tactics. There's focus on the sort of American ideal of the rough and ready, rugged individual. You know, I've always said that Jack Reacher could be a great military sci-fi character if you just stuck him on another planet killing aliens instead of, you know, bad guys on Earth. And then it's also kind of reflected in the 80s action movies like Rambo type Stallone, Chuck Norris, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Again, you know, if you put any of them in a space suit with a laser gun, that's pretty much how the American school operates.
And then there's also that, a lot of that Vietnam era sense of, you know, it's us against the guys above us. Yeah, so that's sort of how I see the American school.
And that's interesting, because now, first off, I have to admit, I have never read David Drake, I've never read David Weber, Johnny Ringo, any of them. So I'm not familiar with that side of it, but I have read, you know, what I consider are the American sci-fi books as well, and they do sort of reflect that. And the one that started me off on it was Forever War, which is by John Haldeman, and he straight up is acknowledged that is his response to what happened in Vietnam. That's why he wrote that book. And so it fits, dovetails, if you will, really nicely with your theory. So I've got one book, you know, at the very least that supports your theory so far. So, all right.
All right. So the British school, you ready?
Yeah, I want to hear it.
All right. So the British school is more books by people like Dan Abnett, Graham McNeil, Aaron Dembski Bowden. They all write for, among other people, Black Library, which is Games Workshop, which is Warhammer, but also Peter F. Hamilton to a degree. See, this is where we get into a little bit of a gray area, Shag, is that there's a new school of space opera that's come along in the last 20 years, and they bleed over into military sci-fi a lot, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, I would argue that maybe the difference between contemporary space opera and military sci-fi is whether the folk, in both cases, you've got military stuff going on. I think a lot of it just depends on the background, how big of a story it is, right? Space opera tends to be bigger, have governments and, you know, empires and stuff, whereas military sci-fi often is more focused on the individual soldier or a battalion or an operation or something like that. But again, there's a lot of gray area and bleed over. So
I did a little research, okay. Leading up to this on that. And this is just who knows, website ABC. So this is not necessarily authoritative. But one definition I kind of liked was that space opera focuses on the more adventurous stories and has a lot of melodrama. And the principal characters in the space opera are not military personnel, but are civilians or paramilitary. Whereas military science fiction tends to focus more on warfare and technical aspects. It's an interesting definition. I don't know if there's any validity to it or not, but I see what you mean. Yeah, the line, because I started looking up what is space opera, and I'm like, I could argue that every sci-fi book I've ever read is space opera then, you know? So it's like, wow, yes. Okay, interesting.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's true. I would say what makes the British school different and unique is that it often includes elements of sort of gothic horror.
Mm-hmm.
If you imagine like the cover of any Warhammer 40K novel, you get a sense, right, of that.
Right.
It's as much horror as it is sci-fi. Like I said, Alien, from the standpoint of the Space Marines, is kind of American military sci-fi. Alien, from the standpoint of the aliens and like the first Alien movie, is a little more the British school in a way, which would make sense with Ridley Scott. There's often an emphasis on that mood, that setting. It's darker, it's gloomy. There's monsters, there's aliens, there's supernatural stuff that you don't really get any supernatural stuff in the American school. It's all technical, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the British school has the supernatural in it. It's heavily influenced not by Vietnam. The lasting British scar is not Vietnam, obviously. It's World War One. It's the trenches. It's losing a whole generation of young men, you know, in the fields of France and Belgium and Germany.
Wow.
So there's that focus on the trench warfare, the futility of it all, the horror of the mass combat and the casualties. And the other thing you get in the British school more is that class system and the aristocracy against the commoners. It's kind of the same thing you see in like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings. Like I always put it this way, Frodo is a British science military sci-fi character, and Samwise is an American military sci-fi character, right? You know what I mean? But there's that sense of trying to overcome that class discrimination. The officers don't listen to me because I'm not an aristocrat like them, but I know what I'm talking about, and they don't, right? Because they're all inbred idiots. And so a good example outside of that genre is like the Sharp novels that Ned Stark did, the Sharp, yeah, back in the Napoleonic War. It's the same kind of thing. If you put Sharp in outer space, it's basically Alien Legion with a British Alien Legion, you know. Sean Bean is who I was trying to think of, by the way.
Okay.
So it's not as focused on the technology being slick and cool. It's more focused on like the setting and the surroundings and the mood. That's kind of how I would define the two.
That's fascinating. Because, like, I have no experience in this area at all. Well, maybe I do. I mean, not in military, but, like, Doctor Who. I read a ton of Doctor Who novels. And I don't mean adaptions of the TV show, but, like, original novel fiction. And all these are by British writers. And now that you mention it, there is a whole lot of stuff in there with class system arguments. There's a lot of stuff that is dark and atmospheric and losing side. And I just assumed it was more influenced by World War II, you know, the bombing of London and stuff. But absolutely, World War I would be a major impact. So this is all absolutely – and Dan Abnett. Okay, so I've never read any of the military sci-fi by Dan Abnett. Hold on. Wait, I have one on my shelf. Something called Embedded. It's been sitting on my shelf for a couple of weeks. Maybe I need to jump in this now. But I've read his comic book work, superhero, and his sci-fi stuff, which was phenomenal. And I actually read a couple of Doctor Who books by him, which were also very good. And my stepson reads some of the Dan Abnett Warhammer books. And here's me making fun of myself in a roundabout way. You know, I'm over here saying my Star Wars books are good, right? Well, I've turned my nose up at the Warhammer books all these years because I'm like, oh, well, that's just a board game, you know, tie-in. Right. And so I've never read one, but to hear someone say that, no, these are great, this is quality stuff. My stepson loves them as well. So this is fascinating to me. Huh.
Yeah. Oh, and Dan is a good friend of mine, too. I dearly love him. I think he's one of the most brilliant writers working today. And he does a lot of stuff. That Embedded novel is his own original novel.
Okay.
But he's written quite a few. And I'll say this. There's Warhammer 40K, but there's also Warhammer 30K, which is slightly different. And I'm sure some of your listeners will know this. But
like, what the heck is like, that? I've never heard of that.
It's 10,000. All right. So, well, as we always say, okay. Warhammer 40K.
Van, I think we could all figure out there's a 10,000 difference. We knew that much.
Yeah. You got me there. Basically, Warhammer 40,000 is described as not 2 minutes to midnight, but like 30 seconds after midnight in the galaxy or in the universe, whatever, right? The apocalypse has happened and we're dealing with it. Warhammer 30,000 begins, it's a whole big new series they did the last 10 years or so. It begins with the humans going out into the universe in a very American military sci-fi kind of a school mold, right? Going out the triumphant, look at us, we're awesome, we're going out and conquering the universe, and then everything goes to crap, right? They run into the supernatural stuff. That's what gets them. They're winning all the technological battles, and then they run into the supernatural stuff of chaos, and it starts perverting and converting some of their leading figures to the dark side. And so Warhammer 30K is really about the corruption and the fall of man that leads us to Warhammer 40,000. And so it's got a huge space opera component, but a lot of it is written from the standpoint of the Space Marines and the Imperial Guard, who are like the regular human foot soldiers. And that's very much military sci-fi. But, and, you know, because it's very much about the kind of the micro level, the grunts, you know, but they're dealing with these big galactic, you know, crises and problems. And so you really get like a foot soldier's point of view, as well as like these almost these gods that lead their legion. So it's all different levels. But yeah, that's Abnett, that's Graham McNeil, and the rest of the Black Library people.
Follow-up question for you. So these weren't, because these Warhammer books, they sound fascinating, right? Like you've got me on the hook here, and you could have just stopped at Dan Abnett, quite frankly. But so can anyone jump right in, or is you got to read the series one to book 742? Oh,
that's a really good question. I would say this, for Warhammer 40,000, you can really jump in anywhere.
Okay.
What Dan Abnett did in 40,000 was create Gaunt's Ghosts, which is basically the Sharp novels in outer space, right? It's the lone officer and his men that all the aristocrats think are garbage, and they're just waiting for him to die. They give them all the crap missions to go out and get killed in, and they always win, see, and survive and defy the odds, and they defy their own brass, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Very much like Sharp. And so those are cool. And you can just read any of the Gaunt's Ghost books by Abnett and have a great time. But for Warhammer 30K, for the Horus Heresy, as it's called, you really probably want to read the first one, which is Dan Abnett's Horus Rising. That's the one where in the beginning, humans are great. We're all in one big happy family. We're going out and conquering the universe together. And that's when the corruption hits. And it is a great novel. Horus Rising by Dan Abnett is a great novel. And it's part military sci-fi. It's part horror. It's an aliens. It's part gothic. And it's part space opera. And it gets the whole ball rolling. I wouldn't read every book after that. I have a lot of them here. I mainly just kind of stuck to the Abnett and McNeil books and a couple of others, because some of their writers are better than others, honestly. It just depends on what you like.
Yeah, anytime there's a series, that's always going to happen, right?
Yeah. And,
but you've definitely piqued my interest. I mean, I used to play the Warhammer tabletop game back in the 90s, you know, with the Space Marines and the Eldar and all the different.
Oh, yeah.
So I remember bits and pieces of it. So, yeah. All right. So that leads us to our next topic, and maybe you, I don't know if there's an American versus British distinction here, but like, what do you feel, and I feel, what do we feel like makes a strong book in the military sci-fi genre? Like, what are some traits that you're looking for that signify a great book, or maybe they should aspire to? And then what the opposite, what are some pitfalls that we see people fall into with the genre?
Right. Well, I think it's just got to be a good story. It's got to be a good book, regardless of setting. It needs to have strong characterization, because one of the issues that I had with the older military sci-fi stuff from the Vietnam era and all was just that, you know, the authors would come up with cool technology and a cool battle or something, but I didn't care about the characters. They didn't give me any reason to like anybody in it. Mm-hmm. So that's always important. And then, so that's a pitfall and something that can make it strong if you do it right. The technology can be really great. It should not drive the plot, right? It shouldn't be the main point. It should just be along for the ride, in my opinion. Like, you know, and a great example of this, I think we can agree that while Star Wars is not military sci-fi, there's certainly plenty of military sci-fi in Star Wars, and they hardly ever explain any of the technology in Star Wars, right? It just all is there. It all works.
Yep.
Nobody knows how it works. It just works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of thing. You know, again, in the American school, there's more of a demand to know all the technical aspects. I will say that the American school is often tech heads, you know, guys that really and gals that really want to understand how things work. In the British school, nobody worries about it. It's funny. In Warhammer, they say the Space Marines fire their bolters. I've read 15 Space Marine novels where they fire bolters. If you ask me, what is a bolter? I have no idea. I don't even know what it shoots. Is it shooting a bullet? Is it shooting an energy beam? Is it a pistol? I don't know. They just pull out their bolter and shoot and people die. And I'm like, okay. You know, in American military sci-fi, you couldn't do that because they would demand, what is it? You have to tell me how it works. What's the ammunition look like? How big is the ammunition, right?
I'm part of the problem. Like when I'm reading an L. Ron Hubbard book or something, right? And he spends 6 pages talking about how a laser gun works. I'm like, give me more. I am here for that.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's Tom Clancy right there. See, now you go off the Tom Clancy side. I think if Clancy had lived about 20 more years, he would have absolutely written some military sci-fi, because he was a big fan of another name we're going to mention, Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. And so he could have gotten into that genre no problem over time, and he would have given you 50 pages of how the gun works. You know that Tom Clancy would have given you 50 pages of how that gun works.
I never read a Tom Clancy novel, but I trust you.
Shag, there's a Tom Clancy novel where somebody mentions a piece of furniture and he spends like 5 pages growing the tree to cut it down and make the piece of furniture. Oh, I kid you not.
I probably would have loved it. Be careful.
There you go. Well, all right. So we were talking about what makes for a strong book.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that part of it too depends on the audience, because a lot of military sci-fi readers are military people, and that's great. God bless them. I mean, that's something that I'm sure they have a great interest in, and they want to know more stuff like that. Whereas non-military folks just enjoy a great story, an action story, watching, like I said, professionals do a job. So I think that I don't know that the rules are hard and fast, because you have completely different audiences that are reading these things too.
No, that's fair. And I love your analogy or description of saying professionals doing a job well, because like I never even considered that. But that's absolutely one of the joys when you're reading it and you see the squad go and they effectively execute the mission and it works, or even if it doesn't work, but they effectively did their part. Like, yeah, there's a satisfaction to that. And things that I like that I feel like make up a strong novel, and I'm not saying all these have to be in there, but is the military structure, like, you know, the fighting unit, the chain of command, the orders, you know, it sort of allows the reader a shortcut to jump right in, because we all have a common understanding of the way the military works. And I've read a lot of other books and I don't even know what genre they fall under, like that are about like bounty hunters or mercenaries that are former military, right? So there's still a lot of similarities to the military sci-fi, but they're a rogue guy on their own, you know, clearly the American model. So I don't even know if that still counts as military sci-fi or not, but I like it better when there's a platoon or a group or whatever. I love a good boot camp story. I am a sucker for a good boot camp story where, you know, the guy goes in and gets his ass beat and, you know, this drill sergeant hates him and then he earns the drill sergeant's respect. You know, give me Full Metal Jacket with bug-eyed monsters every day. I don't care how many times I read that story. I will read it again and it makes me happy. typically the mission goes awry and they have to overcome crazy obstacles. That's great. An important thing for me, and I mentioned this when I mentioned the X-Wing books, is space combat that as a reader I can follow and visualize. That's really key to me because, like, I've read some books where I don't really understand what's happening. There's ships there. They're shooting each other. That guy won. That guy didn't. Okay. But if they're doing, again, they're accurately describing a dogfight in space and I can follow it, hell yeah. That's fantastic. That's great writing right there. And then I enjoy the world building. Like, I want to hear about the cultures or the governments or the planets or whatever. I don't want to just be, okay, we landed on planet X4. Let's go kill some bugs. No, I want to hear about why this planet matters. You know, why are they there? What's the political landscape? Why are they fighting over it? That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, what about pitfalls? I've got a pretty healthy list of pitfalls I've seen in some military sci-fi hunts. What have you seen writers fall into?
Let me address your mission goes awry thing first, because I love that you said that because I hadn't thought about it. I just a minute ago gave my endorsement to Darwin Cook's Parker heist adaptations, right? Of all those mm-hmm. Parker novels. They're exactly the same structure, and I hadn't really thought about it. In both cases, you have a team that goes on a mission, but also the mission often goes awry and it relies on, like, the hero to get him out of trouble, right?
Yep.
In the military or military sci-fi story, it's like the lieutenant, the captain, the private, whoever that, you know, saves everybody. In the heist books, there's the one heister that's really good and is like not hung up on the dame or not an alcoholic or not, you know, not trying to steal from the others. And he usually has to kind of, and Parker's always that character, right? Every Parker book, he has to bail everybody out, sometimes by killing a whole lot of people, as they say in Sin City. But so it's kind of the same. I hadn't thought about it, but these are two genres that have kind of the same structure, just kind of in opposite directions. You know, they're one's doing something bad and you still root for them. The other's doing something good and you root for them. So that's kind of cool. Pitfalls, though, I mean, I think that you're right in terms of some of the things that I know that you've mentioned. But I think that when you look at military sci-fi that's been done back in the day, like the Vietnam guys, they tended to be maybe a little more of their era. So there was a little more sexism. The female characters were not very well developed. They were treated badly. They were just, you know, set decoration. It's all manly, rough men. But any of that is just a product of its time. So today, you shouldn't be running into that, I don't think, in contemporary stories, not from a reputable publisher anyway.
I'll expand on that one real quick. One of the pitfalls I've seen, and some of this is older, because this is not military sci-fi, but like there's a Piers Anthony book I read recently, Bio of a Space Tyrant. I read the first one of those. Been meaning to read it for 30 years, finally got around to it. And sexual assault is something that seems to come up in a lot of these books. And some of them I've seen more recently. Like anytime there's space pirates, the author seems to be lean in towards the threat of men raping women. And it's not explicit in the book. You know, they don't necessarily go into it actually happening, but the threat is always there. They're always talking about it and the dangers towards the female characters. And that's a pitfall that I've seen a lot of writers fall into. And yes, I can imagine if we're out in space and that kind of piracy might be going on, maybe that's the thing. But I don't need to read it in my book all the time. My escapism, my book, you know? Mm-hmm,
right. No, I remember that. I remember that first book, and you're exactly right. I read it in like high school or college, and I can still remember that was the thing that stood out from that book was all the sexual assault. Absolutely. Yeah.
In fact, I finished that book, and I took all five of them, didn't read the rest of them, took them to the used bookstore, sold them for credit.
Bingo. Yeah, so, that's the only one I read, 100%. Yep.
So I have other pitfalls I'll run through real quick here. And if you've got any more, feel free to chime in here. So the first one is, and I've seen this more in, like, I don't know how to distinguish. You've got your sci-fi writers that are being published, you go to Books a Million and you find, and then there's a ton, and I mean a ton, guys, of people writing sci-fi, military sci-fi, that are just self-publishing. You know, they're just creating it. It's an ebook, and you can buy it through your Kindle for whatever. And I've gotten a lot of those through various means. I have a newsletter I get that has free books every day. And if they get at least a 4.0, I'll buy the book. I don't care, as long as it's sci-fi. I have like 300 of these things now. And some of these folks are basically, they're just masking their own ethnocentric beliefs or their political beliefs, right? And they're just putting it out in space. Or worse, they're masking their bigotry towards either cultures or races. I've seen several where, you know, the bad guys are clearly, okay, these are the Russians. Okay, these are clearly the Chinese. You know, those are the bad guys. Like a lot of stereotypes. That's a pitfall I don't necessarily enjoy seeing happen a lot. Then there's the space fantasy one. Like, you know, they put the space wizards in this, in the supernatural, like supernatural horror is one thing, but just having people with powers or the idea that there's one chosen one, you know, there's a prophecy and the chosen one has to save the galaxy. You know, that's not always my favorite. I'd rather see a military mission with, you know, your Joe Everyman, you know, would be my preferred. Too much humor. I've seen that sometimes. I don't need to go a lot of it, but some of, like, I was reading this one series, really enjoying it, and then they introduced a goofy shape-changing alien for
no way.
And it was like, this has gone wrong horribly. the other is being a little too clever with language. And I'm going to take a dig at a very famous book and a very famous author, and I'm sure people are going to be outraged, but Robert Heinlein. I've only ever read one of his books, which is a shame. I should have read more, right? But I've read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which, amazing sci-fi concepts in there. Really fascinating stuff. A look at hard life out in space. But the thing that, and it wasn't military sci-fi, I know that, but I'm just using an example. He had all this futuristic slang in the book that was really hard to follow. Like, you had to spend a good chunk of the book just trying to figure out what people were saying. And I enjoy a challenge when I'm reading, but this wasn't fun. This was too much. So when a sci-fi book relies too heavily on, you know, made up futuristic slang that to the point where you can't interpret it, that gets a little frustrating too. Those are just some pitfalls. I probably sound whiny, but that's just some stuff I've come across.
No, I think that's all legit. That's good stuff. I agree with you.
So now's the fun part. Now's where we get to pimp some of our favorite stuff. Yep. So we're gonna talk about favorite books, favorite series, favorite authors, and so I'm dying to hear, and I'm gonna be jotting down notes here, some of your British recommendations. I've gotten some more pedestrian suggestions, but you go first. Let's hear some.
Well, I'd start in the U.S. with good old Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, if you consider some of their stuff to be military stuff. I think that a lot of Purnell's was, and I think that when they got together, it often was. Niven by himself, not so much, right? Like, you know, even Ringworld, which has a lot of military-type action, and it is really a civilian mission. But when they would get together, I think the Purnell influence on Larry would shine through, and especially the Mode in God's Eye series, which is basically set on a military fleet of ships, you know, in the galaxy dealing with aliens and stuff. And so that, I think that's right up there as an all-timer, the Mote in God's Eye.
That shows up on lists all the time, like the top sci-fi books ever. And I've never read it, never gotten it, but people have recommended it to me. So, all right. So if you're endorsing it, that's a big plus.
I will say this, two things about it. One, when it was published, I believe they got Heinlein to say it was the best science fiction novel ever written.
Wow.
This is cool. Heinlein sent them back like one single spaced full page of notes and said, if you make all these changes, I will say it's the best science fiction book ever published. And they did.
Wow. Okay.
They did everything Robert Heinlein told them to do. I've interviewed Larry Niven at DragonCon and Jerry Purnell several times, and I think that's what Larry said, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's what he said. So anyway.
I would accuse you of being a name dropper, but instead I'm going to say, damn, that's amazing.
I drop names all the time. It's all I have in this life, Shag. It's what I have to cling to. So let a man have his thing, okay?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That's certainly a classic. But the other thing I was going to say about it, I read it in high school. I don't know how it holds up. You know what I'm saying? You know, things that were great in the mid-80s may not be great in 2024. I don't remember. Let's see. I talked about Warhammer 30K, 40K already. Mm-hmm. Those are good depending on who the author is and so forth. And the other thing, by the way, the other thing that's cool about them is that they cover different, like there's the Imperial Guard, which are like foot soldiers. There's the Space Marine novels and short stories, which are these like giant, you know, superhuman guys in armor that are just godlike. There's the Titans, which are like giant, like Pacific Rim, you know, tight rope, kaiju and all that and robots. So there's a lot of stuff inside that universe. Honestly, the Warhammer universe in sci-fi is about as big as the Marvel universe, just with space stuff instead of superhero stuff. It really is.
Wow.
And by the way, Superman, you know, the most recent Superman.
Oh, Henry Cavill. Yeah.
Henry Cavill is currently trying to bring us the Warhammer extension. extended cinematic universe. So God bless him.
Well, I didn't know whether he was doing fantasy or 40K. So is he doing 40K?
I think he's doing 40K.
Oh,
I hope so.
Okay.
Because Warhammer Fantasy is basically just Lord of the Rings with the serial numbers filed off of the wand or whatever.
Right.
But,
yeah,
you know. All right. Peter F. Hamilton, British writer, the Night's Dawn trilogy, Judas Unchained, all those. Again, it's not as gothic, but in the Night's Dawn saga, you got all this high tech, very American school stuff. And then suddenly they're bringing the dead back to life by torturing living people until they give up their life and the dead take over their bodies. Yeah. And I'm like, yep, this is British. It just took a sharp British turn right there, right? So,
all right.
Yes, but very entertaining. And then let's talk about, well, all right, before we get to that, I'm going to mention two others that are unquestioned, and I got one we need to talk about.
All right.
W. Michael Gear, he's best known, he and his wife write these books about like cave people, the people of the bear, the people of the forest, whatever. They're famous for that. But back in the early 90s, he wrote a gigantically thick trilogy called the Forbidden Borders trilogy. And I'm currently rereading them because I found them at a half price books. I'd given mine away 20 years ago, but I found them again. I'm like, oh, I got to reread these, you know, and they're just like, I would say they're space opera, but they're very much from the level of the foot soldier in a kind of a going up against the bugs, what you call it, the Heinlein.
Okay. Like Starship Troopers kind of thing.
It's very much in a Starship Troopers mode, but it's in kind of a space opera universe rather than than just a single war between two planets, kind of War of the Worlds kind of thing. So they're fun. It's just kind of all, it's a big sprawling mess, but a fun mess. So I'll give it that.
Right.
And now I got to go in comics. There's one in comics I've got to mention because it is so good. Christopher Muller, who is best known as an artist for Magic the Gathering cards, probably.
Oh, okay.
And he's done some stuff for DC, but he's probably best known as a Magic the Gathering painter. But he's painted three separate military sci-fi stories. And it was originally called Shadow Empires, this universe, but the first one came out about the same time as Shadows of the Empire, that Star Wars story.
Okay, all right.
So he changed the name to Iron Empires. And it's kind of an American version of Warhammer 40,000. You got these guys in the Marines in the big armor that jump out of the spaceships and crash into the ground and pop up as, you know, Iron Man, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fighting against these alien invaders and all their minions and everything. It's Faith Conquers, Shiva's War, and then they did one that's more about space combat called Void. And if you can get a hold of these, they're kind of hard to find. They've been reprinted as graphic novels, all three of them, but it'd be Iron Empire's Faith Conquers, Iron Empire's Shiva's War, and Iron Empire's Void. They're fully painted. Every panel, every page is painted, and it reads like Dune meets American military sci-fi, right? It's just it's this incredibly, incredibly well fleshed out set of worlds with like religious orders and diabolical scheming and politics, and then these alien invaders that take over people's bodies, and then these space marines that are fighting them, and the clash between the church and the marines and everything. It's just, oh, it's so good. It's so good, man.
Is it still in print anywhere, or we got to find back issues?
Yeah, no, it should be. I looked on the website that you spoke about, and they didn't have it, but that's not surprising because it hadn't really been in big print for a while.
Okay.
In fact, Boyd was a Kickstarter a few years ago, and he's been doing games lately. Moeller's kind of gone over to doing board games now. He's done a lot of like Napoleonic and Civil War board games, so where he paints the board and paints all the cards and all the figurines,
nice,
and everything. Yeah, but if you can get a hold of these three graphic novels, man, I'm telling you, they are really special. They're really good. Now, the one I want to ask you about is The Expanse, because you and I have spoken about this, and we're trying to figure out if they qualify. So what do you think about The Expanse?
Okay, so now I've only read the first book, and I read it twice. And honestly, the first time I didn't really like it. I don't know what was wrong with me, because the second time, because a friend told me, like, no, you need to reread it again. You're just stupid. So I reread it again, and I'm like, oh my God, it's so good. I love this. And I had watched the TV series before I ever read the book. So at least the first season. I watched the first season. So totally loved it. Great, compelling, absolutely a page turner, but I just don't see how it qualifies for military sci-fi, and yet it appears on every military sci-fi list. So is it like books 2, 3, 4, 5 suddenly become a military story and I'm just not there yet, or am I just stupid?
Well, you know what's funny is I read the first book and didn't really like it.
Okay.
And so I've never read the other book, so you and I are the same on that. when the TV show came along, I said, oh, good. Now I don't have to read the other books. I can just watch the TV show. Fantastic.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
And I really like the TV show. It's and good. I'll tell you, the reason why I think that it does qualify, and it may be that it just takes time to get there.
All right.
But in the later books, one of the main characters is a Marine, a Space Marine woman.
Okay.
And she kicks butt. You get a lot more of like the Martian Navy versus the Earth Navy and the outer, the, you know, whatever the other people are. It's been a while since I watched it, but mm-hmm. you basically have the Earth, you have Mars, and you have the Belt or whatever, right?
The Belters, right.
Yeah. And they each have their own different type of Navy, and there's a lot of fleet actions and ship actions. There's Marines fighting. So yeah, the first book is more of a, you know, like introducing the situation, getting to know the characters, and there's like that alien infestation thing or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
and a detective story. Yes, as it goes along, though, it becomes much more about the United Nations and the Mars government and these space fleets. And then there's like a villain that tries to destroy the Earth by, you know, using meteors to hit the Earth, and they're sending spaceships out to fight him and all. So I think by that point, it definitely qualifies.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I'll give it. And personally, I am not in favor of anyone destroying the Earth. That's where I keep my stuff. So
I know.
Totally against that.
So did you say you have not watched but the first season of it?
I watched the first season, and then I watched a couple episodes of the second season, and it's not like I didn't like it. I just, life got in the way. Oh, and right. I thought I was going to read the books. That was it. I thought I was going to read the books. I'm like, I'll hold off. And then, like I said, right. I didn't like the first one. And it was actually Ryan Daly, who's on our network. It was his wife who pretty much just slapped me and said, you're an idiot. Read the book again. And she was right. It was a great read the second time. I just loved it.
I'm not going to read it again. I'm just going to leave it where you left it the first time. It's okay. But like I say, yeah, the TV show does a really good job. And I think if you watch the later seasons, you will see why it's on that list. Yeah.
Okay. Well, since we're talking about questionable ones, before I get to my list of my stuff, I do have another one I'm wondering about. You mentioned the book Dune a couple times here in different regards.
Yes.
And all these top, you know, military sci-fi lists tend to include Dune. Now, I just got done reading Dune. I read it for the first time the other day. Awesome. just the first one. It's a great book, but I don't get how anyone could qualify at least the first one as a military sci-fi. I don't get that.
I think they see the Sardaukar and the Fedaiken and fighting each other, and there's laser guns, however you pronounce them, and they just figure, oh, military sci-fi. And in the later Dune, and I only really count the six that Herbert wrote. I know that Kevin J. Anderson and Herbert's son, but
right.
That's fine. But in the original six books, a couple of the later ones are a little more, you know, because the later Dune books, the focus moves from like the Atreides family to more the Bene Gesserit being the heroes, believe it or not. And because they're around, right? People come and go, but the organizations are kind of eternal, basically.
Sure.
So, you know, you go so far into the future by the fifth and sixth books that it's really more the Bene Gesserit or the heroes. They do a lot of military action. So, I mean, if you look at the six books, I can kind of see there's enough military stuff going on. But I agree with you, though, that that's never the main focus, really.
Yeah, it feels more like space fantasy because you've got the Chosen One and then all the hippy-dippy shrooms and all this stuff for the spice and all that. Like, because if someone's going to plant their flag and say Dune is a military sci-fi book, then I'm going to plant my flag and say Battlefield Earth is as well, which I don't think is a military sci-fi book, but I feel like Dune and that have a lot in common as far as telling a story and the threat and all the, and you're fighting rebellion, all that kind of stuff. And I just love Battlefield Earth. I think it's a great damn book. But anyway. All right. So I'll run through some of my picks here for people. So I've already mentioned The Forever War by Joe Haldeman. Fantastic sci-fi story. Really interesting about, and from what I understand, you know, I wasn't there in the 70s when he wrote it, but I understand it was fairly forward thinking as far as like the traveling of distances. The whole idea that the soldiers go into cryo sleep and come out, you know, I don't know, 80, 100 years later to go fight a battle. And, you know, when they come home, so, you know, hundreds of years have passed by the time they get home from a mission. And so they're completely out of sync with everyone that they've ever loved. So that's kind of an interesting idea.
For sure.
Then the thing that I'm super passionate about right now is John Scalzi. I found his stuff on a whim. I was in a Books a Million, and I was looking at, like, you know, they package books together in like a box set or something. Like, you know, here's three books you can buy together. And I was looking, I'm like, boy, it just like you mentioned about looking at covers, I'm like, these covers look great. These look like old school sci-fi covers for a series he did called The Old Man's War. And so instead of buying the set, I was cautious. I went off and bought a single copy of one, and I looked on Amazon. The reviews were good. I'm like, all right, I'll read this. Holy crap, I become obsessed with John Scalzi and the Old Man's War. There's, I don't know, something like 9 books, I think, altogether. I don't know how many. I'm on book 5 right now. And just absolutely loving it. His prose, it just reads so naturally and comfortably. It's engaging. It's an interesting setting where the basic idea, at least from the framing of the first one, is when you turn 75 years old, you have a choice. You can either grow old naturally on Earth, or you can go off and join the military and go off and fight this war. And what they don't tell you until, you know, they don't tell the 75-year-olds how it happens, but they basically upload your mind into a new body is what they do. And so it goes from there. And it's just really engaging the way he writes. And each book surprises me. Like, I keep thinking, okay, you know, this is the fifth book. It's going to be wash, rinse, repeat here, right? No, it's a new spin every single time. Like the fifth one I'm reading right now, basically he wrote them as individual little short stories. So it's like every 30 pages, you get a short story that builds the larger narrative of the novel, but you're like, whenever you're reading, you're like, okay, I can read another page. It's just 30 pages. I'll just blow through this right now. And I just can't put it down. So, absolutely love those. I also read his Interdependency trilogy, which was phenomenal as well. Anyway, Ender's Game, Orson Scott Card. It was one of those that showed up on, you know, best sci-fi books you need to read. Absolutely love that one. You guys have probably all seen the movie. You already know the big reveal about what's really going on. But, it's a great, I don't want to call it coming-of-age story, but it's a great, you know, growing up sort of disconnected kid having a hard time fitting in. And, you know, it's a little bit like a boot camp kind of story too, right? Because they're going in there and training.
For sure.
And those are more traditional. Then I get into, you know, I mentioned earlier, there's a whole bunch of like, you know, people publish Kindle only kind of stuff. There's a series called Drop Trooper, written by a writer named Rick Partlow. And I kind of stumbled across that. It's one of those where I think I bought it for 99 cents on Amazon or even got it for free, whatever. And I didn't go in expecting much, but it really grabbed me. I didn't think about it till you started describing it. It's a little bit like the Space Marine idea. It's the guys in the big tank armor. You know, they drop these troopers in these giant armors and they go, you know, take down a city, you know, like a platoon of them will go take down a city, and they're fighting other giant troopers as well. Not kaiju sized, but, you know, more Iron Man sized.
Right.
And the thing that surprised me, like, I kind of figured where the book was going, but then in the first one, at least, he threw me a complete curve and the book went a whole different direction. I'm like, oh, this is kind of nice. I like being surprised when I'm reading a book. And I like, you know, in the combat, you can completely follow what's going on. There's a great boot camp story in there. I just read the second one the other day and it equally just as engaging. Again, I thought, okay, it's going to be wash, rinse, repeat, but it's not. The mission was completely different, a different idea. By the time they got to the big mission, I was completely engrossed in it. So I'm really enjoying that. In fact, I went off and read one of his other books about a mercenary that I enjoyed as well. So I really like Rick Partlow, what he's doing. I don't think you're ever going to find one in a bookstore. I think you have to buy it, you know, online. But Earthrise, I've only read the first one of these. A guy named Daniel Aronson, I think is how you say his name, Aronson. People seem to love his stuff, so I thought I'd try this Earthrise series. It's a pretty traditional Starship Troopers kind of thing, you know, but the aliens have come to Earth, and so the humans are fighting them off. Again, a lot of boot camp type stuff in there, but I enjoyed it. It grabbed me. He was able to give us a diverse cast of people that you could follow. Didn't go too deep, but I enjoyed it. So I thought that was a lot of fun. I'll mention just two more real briefly. Battle Group Z by Daniel Gibbs. The thing that I would describe about this is that he does the combat and the dogfights extremely well, but it's basically Battlestar Galactica is really kind of where he's going. I mean, a lot of the lingo's the same. It feels very Battlestar Galactica kind of clonish, but then it kind of goes off after a while a little bit different in the way the alien, the other humans they're fighting is different. That one has no aliens in it. They're just fighting other colonies of humans, which is sort of interesting. And one of the things I thought was kind of pleasantly surprising is the way they handled religion. Like, he goes into religion quite a bit because the ship is composed of completely people with different religions, lots of different religions, and each one respects and celebrates each other's beliefs. They're not fighting each other over religion for a change. And it made a really refreshing kind of way to handle that. I thought it was really good. And then Grimm's War is another series by a guy named Jeffrey Haskell. Kind of stumbled upon this one, but couldn't put it down. It wasn't anything revolutionary, but it was a solid sci-fi one. And basically, you know, it's the guy who gets put in charge of the ship that's falling apart, and they think he's going to fail, so they put him in charge of this. Okay, you know, we don't like this guy. We want him to fail. We're going to put him in charge of a ship that's, you know, a battleship that's falling apart. And of course, he gets the battleship fixed up. He whips them into a great fighting crew. And that one, I would say the bad guys are kind of stereotypical. Like, okay, this planet of bad guys are clearly the Russians. Okay, this planet is clearly maybe the Middle East, so a Middle Eastern country, that kind of thing. But if you can at least accept that, the stereotypes, it's a fun read. I mean, the guy was a great writer, so I enjoyed that. There's a bunch of other ones I've read, but those are just a few I'll mention off the top of my head.
Nice.
Now, I want to ask you, there's some classics that I've never touched. And just, you know, 2 seconds, thumbs up, thumbs down, haven't read, whatever. You know, Starship Troopers, Robert. And I keep saying, I always said Heinlein, but you're saying it's Heinlein. Is that right?
I don't know.
Well, I would assume you're more right than me. But Starship Troopers, have you read it?
No, I've never actually read any of Heinlein, however you want to say it. I've never read any of his stuff, but I'm fairly familiar with it. And surely that's got to be, you know, that's like a prototypical. Yep. That was like old school military sci-fi.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think most authors in this genre use that as sort of a template. Yeah. You mentioned David Weber, like his famous series, I guess, is Honor Harrington. Seen tons of those in the bookstores, but I've never touched one. I don't know. You know, I've never heard anyone say, oh, you got to read these, but maybe I should be trying them.
I've heard a lot of people say that. And I mean, it's sort of the backbone of Bayon Books. That's like the probably keeps the lights on at their headquarters.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, Weber's probably their biggest author in their stable. And that series is his main series. So, yeah.
All right. Very cool. And then I'm just going to name check a few, and I'm not necessarily going to put you on the spot and ask you what it is. Some more of these, probably, again, ebook only publishing stuff. Expeditionary Force by Craig Allenson seems to be top all the lists of recent favorites. The Lost Fleet by Jack Campbell, and then Frontlines by Marco Kluse. I've seen a lot of these names keep coming up over and over, so I'm probably going to dip my toe in one of those sooner or later. So just books to keep your eye out for, or if you've read any of them, let us know in the comments.
I see the Lost Fleet mentioned a lot. I've never read it. I don't know much about it, but I see that name a lot. For sure. Okay.
Well, with all those out of the way, let's talk about a book that's about to come out, folks. I'm excited to hear about this. So, Van, you are, as I said, you've written something like 60 books, and you have written a science fiction military story called Alpha Omega. Why don't you give us the pitch? Tell us about it.
All right. Well, the background of this book, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. The background of this book is it's been about 20 years in the making. I had the original idea for it in 2005, and it took me right at 20 years to get it together. I've written a whole, like you said, I've written 21 other novels in the time I've been working on it. So if that tells you anything about it.
Wow.
But what happened, I never was satisfied with it. It kept getting longer and longer, and I would just finally throw it away and start over or back up. And over the years, I kept adding to it and then changing it around and so forth. It got published as a much shorter book back in 2019 by Prose Press. And they had it for a couple of years. And I said to their editor, I said, I appreciate you guys publishing it, but you know what? I'm just not happy with it. It's still not the story I want it to be. And he's like, you can have it back. You know, that's fine. Just, you know, do it. We don't want to mess you up. Take it back. So I took it back and I spent on and off for the last 3 years revamping the entire thing. And I'm finally completely more than happy with it. I love it. I'm so excited about it. So here's the basic idea of it. Mm-hmm. It comes from my love of Space 1999 originally, but it goes way beyond that now. My original thought was Space 1999 could have been so much better if the Russian commander that they removed from office in the first episode on the moon hadn't gotten sent back to Earth right before they blew off into the universe, right before the nuclear waste disposal areas blew up. Mm-hmm. I said, wouldn't it have been cool if you'd had the American commander and the former Russian commander both on the base, and even as they're confronting these menaces out across the universe, you've got the Russians and the Americans and the British kind of squaring off on the base. And you know, you get a little of that new Battlestar Galactica where there was factions that developed, mm-hmm. you know. That's what I thought was one of the really cool things about the new versus the old Battlestar Galactica was you had a lot of the internal politics of the fleet that you didn't really see in the old one, you know. And I thought that would have been really cool, like a civil war while they're trying to survive. You know, here they are trying to survive and they're shooting holes in each other's, you know, environments and everything. So it kind of started there. But I moved it to Alpha, to a moon around a gas giant of Alpha Centauri. And basically I had it turn into essentially not just world war, but like a multi-solar system war between a conspiracy within the Russian government and a sort of a conspiracy in the American government, because the Americans are kind of rolling over. The American president's weak. He doesn't want to fight back and argue with the Russians because they're kind of in a position of advantage at that time politically. And so there's a captain that's just lost the command of his military spacecraft. And so the president goes and gets him and says, you find a way to stop this. And so the first half of this book, and this is the longest single book I've ever written. It's 800 pages long.
Wow.
But it is a military sci-fi tome, right? It is one big, you get to know the characters real well, and there's a lot of action all the way through it. There's like book one is Alpha, book two is Omega. And in the first half, it's basically U.S. Navy Captain Jack Corrigan and two of his top lieutenants, a guy and a girl. And the three of them, they don't have a ship. They don't have any real official authority other than their military rank. And they have to somehow get from Earth to Alpha Centauri before the Russians do, because the Russians are coming to take over Alpha Base on this moon of Alpha Centauri, as a prelude to going to this new planet that's about to be colonized down through a wormhole. And they have to stop the Russians, A, from taking over Alpha Centauri, and B, from going down the wormhole and taking over this new planet. And it's just the three of them. And so in the first half of the book, it's them scrambling to get where they're trying to go and to find allies. And of course, when they get to Alpha Centauri, it's a bunch of scientists, not soldiers. So now, A, they've got to convince these people to get ready to fight a Russian invasion, and B, convince them that they're honest, right, that they should, and see, train them how to fight.
Okay.
So that's the first half. And then the second half, the Russians show up, and you can imagine it gets very, very dicey and very interesting from that point on.
Wow. Okay. So this, I love the pitch of the Space 1999 combined with the politics of BSG, because I mean, that's absolutely what would happen. If you put a bunch of humans out in space, they're totally going to try and screw each other over.
It's
just absolutely what's going to happen. So when you say that there are two books, so you mean it's physically one book though, but you're just saying Act One, Act Two. Okay, gotcha.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's Act One and Act Two, but each is about 400 pages. So each of the two is, you know, a big novel, but the whole thing together is just, you know, it's one of those things where I could have done it as a series of two or three books if I wanted to. That's the way I've done things in the past. But I just decided for once in my writing career, I wanted to write just one big, thick, giant book. And basically I had two books sitting on my desk the whole time I was working on it, just kind of for inspiration. Mm-hmm. And that was the Winds of War and Noble House.
Because
neither one of them is sci-fi, but they're both huge, right?
Yep.
They both have a lot of characters, and they're both these big sprawling war epics. Well, Noble House isn't a war epic, but it's the Cold War, so it might as well be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had those as kind of my touchstones. Every time I kind of got stuck, I would think, you know, how would James Clavell handle this? I mean, yeah, how would Herman Woke handle this? And it's, you know, the thing that really gratifies me about it is I have my hardcover copy sitting on the coffee table in the living room, and every now and then I'll randomly pick it up and just open it to any random page. And when I first got it, I was terrified that I would find every page dull. And, you know, I just say this honestly, every time I pick it up and start reading, I'm like, oh, look at that. Hey, look what I did. Pretty good. It pulls me in. That's what you want, man. You know what
absolutely.
I mean? That's what you want. So I feel like I nailed it this time. I feel like I'm not going to have to sweat it anymore. After 20 years, I got it. This is it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I feel bad for the extra shipping you're probably going to have to spend to ship me an 800-page book, but I was thrilled to be part of the Kickstarter and help support it. So,
I appreciate it.
When you designed, you know, Alpha and Omega, like you mentioned, you wrote the first version in 2019. Was that just maybe a smaller version of the whole tale, or was that just Alpha, or how was it different?
It was. The original story that as I wrote it was it started where the first half of the story ends and then would go through to the end of the second part. And what was funny is I was saying this on Facebook. You may have noticed it over the last couple of years. I'm like, I kept backing up looking for the beginning. You know, they always say one of the hardest things as a writer sometimes is to find where your story actually begins.
Hmm.
Because you need to start early enough that you can get everything in the reader needs to know. But you don't want to start so early that the beginning's boring, right? You need to find exactly the right part to kick off. And I kept backing up. And I said on Facebook that I said I backed it up and I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a short prologue that gets them up to that point. And the prologue ended up being longer than the rest of the book. So yeah, the whole thing of them getting to Alpha Centauri was just like a flashback chapter before. And now the first half of the book, I thought, you know what? That's a really interesting story. I'm giving it too short a shrift by making it a flashback. It needs to be its own thing. And so I just kept backing up and backing up until I found where it really started. And so now where it starts is Captain Corrigan having his ship taken away from him and given to a Russian captain. And he's mad at the Russians. He's mad he's lost his command. And then the president comes to him and says, well, let's harness that because I've got a mission for you. And I'm like, that's where the book starts right there. But that meant I had like 400 pages to write just to get up to where the previous book started. But but it's good stuff, though. It's good because they have to figure out a way to get there. And they find several very clever ways to get there. And the Russians kind of get a sense that they're coming and start sending assassins and hit squads after them. And so it gets very fun as they try to get there.
Well, it sounds like professional people doing professional things like yeah. they like you want them to.
I was gonna say you got Corrigan, who's a great leader, and then his main lieutenant is Sean McGuire, who kind of has a hacker bent. He's the one that kind of gets them into computer systems and stuff. Got to have that. And then there's the, of course, the requisite beautiful lieutenant, Kara Wolf, who is still trying to decide if these guys are geniuses or idiots, and is trying to figure out if she's really part of their little band or not. And they're trying to convince her we know what we're doing, right? So she's kind of our view into this group, because those two guys are really tight. They've been through the wars together, and she's like the new member of the trio, and we kind of through her get to see whether we should like them or not, and you know, root for them or not, and all that. So.
Okay. Sounds like she's the no-nonsense outsider was what it sounds. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So was doing the extra 400 pages, was that the biggest challenge writing the book? Or did you find the military sci-fi genre in general difficult? Because, I mean, I've read some of your superhero stuff. I've read your giant kaiju robot story, Invalidus V, and things like that. So was this genre the biggest challenge getting into, or something else?
No, this genre for me is pretty easy. I wrote the Shattering trilogy, you know, about 10 years ago that's done pretty well for me. That's really more of a Warhammer 40,000 British school. This is more American school. Now, there you go. I'm glad that you got me to say that, which I think is important. I wasn't going to say it. I hadn't thought of it. Is my Shattering trilogy from a few years ago is very much British school. It's my Warhammer stuff.
Okay.
But this is very much shiny, mechanical, you know, soldiers on a mission kind of thing. Very much American school, which I didn't know I had in me. That's another one where I got to do something. I thought I liked the British school better, but it was a lot of fun to do an American, you know, school approach. But God, the challenge to me, I mean, honestly, and this is going to sound kind of petty compared to some of the things I could say, but honestly, one of the biggest challenges was I put the day of the week, the month, the year at the beginning of every chapter. Cause you know, I read a lot of those Tom Clancy type books growing up, and they'd say like, you know, USS Yorktown 3 PM 0300 hours, Tuesday, September 5th, 19, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I always thought that was really cool. And so I did that. This book has 104, I think, chapters, and every one of them has the date and the location, and keeping track of all that and knowing what day of the freaking week it was on June 13th, 2097, that was as hard as anything. I was pulling my hair out just keeping track of who was where when. You know, it's like Tolkien complained about having to keep track of the different members of the Fellowship when they split up, and knowing what phase the moon was in when Frodo was in, you
oh,
know,
gosh.
This part of the, you know, whatever. I'm like, I feel you, man, because it was a challenge just to kind of keep the dates and all. But by comparison, for me, writing the characterization, the dialogue, the action, that's easy. That all comes natural to me.
Okay.
It was just keeping it all organized and, you know, a logical amounts of time passed, you know, and the travel. I had to do like a little diagram of all the ships, how long it would take each one to get from point A to point B to point C. It could Corrigan be on Alpha Centauri before the Russians are here, you know, all that. That was challenging. But now when you read the book, it all, you know, if you don't even think about it, it works. But if you stop and go, wait a minute, did Plexico really do this right? And you get out a calculator or something, it works. Yeah.
Well, I won't be the guy who fact checks you. I'm usually more along for the ride, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, well, I figure in military sci-fi, there's always going to be somebody that goes back and double checks things. So I better
Of course. Yeah. So with you said 2097. So is that where we're set in that? Is that time frame?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I originally set it in 2068 because I wrote it again. Started 20 years ago. I started it in 2068 and started it on my birthday, which would be 100 years from when I was born to the day.
Oh, okay.
And then by the time it took me 20 years to write it, I said, it can't be in 20. That's not far enough.
The classic problem
of near future sci-fi is where do you set it? How many years? And I've always said, you'd have to agree with this if you look about all the movies that have an anniversary, right? They never go far enough in the future.
Right. This is a military sci-fi, but of a certain generation, I think everyone remembers A Runaway Planet, Hurdles Between the Earth and the Moon in the year 1994, Thundar, the Barbarian.
Yeah. And Blade Runner was 2019. So that's right. Yeah. So they never go far enough. Any year you name, I'm like, no, we'll still be just like this.
Right.
So you got to go. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I said it in 20 Alpha's set in 2097. Omega's set in 2098. I'm pretty sure that in 2097 to 2098, we will not even have a base on Alpha Centauri. Right.
Right.
But if I made it much later than that, and this is the problem I think that sci-fi writers run into with this. If you make it much later than that, it starts not seeming like people we can relate to.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. I think that
probably as far as you can really go is like Star Trek 200-300 years in the future. After that, it starts seeming like aliens in human bodies a little bit, so you just have to be careful about that. I'd rather set it at a date that clearly is too soon than alienate the audience from my characters on page one.
It makes perfect sense. And by the way, Star Trek never even came up in this conversation, but it's kind of sci-fi military. An argument could be made. I don't know. And I've read hundreds of those damn books, but
Starfleet. I mean, you know, it depends on how military Starfleet is. It depends on which movie or show you're talking about, honestly.
Yeah. So if someone is, you've already pitched, I guess, BSG and Space 1999. So is there a book? I'm trying to think of what you would put on the back of the book, for fans of, and would it be Space 1999 and BSG, or is there another it's also the Interdependency series by John Scalzi or some other thing. Is there a pitch we could give them at home that's going to get them to buy this book?
Yeah, I don't think it would be comparing it to anything else because I don't think it's as much like Space 1999 as it was 20 years ago when I first had the idea. It really has kind of become its own thing, and I'm pretty happy with that. So, it honestly, even though I didn't ever intend this, it's probably got as much of the Expanse in it now because it's got the UN.
Ooh, okay.
It's got other, it's got the, they do some stuff on Mars briefly on the way, it's got a little bit of that in it, honestly. So, though again, that was never a conscious thing. So, no, I mean, my pitch is just that this, regardless of what it reminds you of, I just think it's a really good story. I think it's one of the best things I've ever done. And not all the Russians are bad. There's Russian characters in it that are very good, that are tight friends with Corrigan and help him and stuff. And I didn't want to make them all stereotypical, right? I wanted to have people on both sides that are good and people on both sides that are bad, and in between and gray. So, I'm really looking forward to getting some feedback and reviews on this more than most things, because, when I do one of my superhero books or whatever, I kind of know what people are going to say. I've done enough of them now, but this is kind of new for me. And I'm just very anxious to see how it goes over because I'm really proud of it. I'm very harsh on myself usually. So it's very unusual for me to say this. That's why I'm saying, I feel pretty good about it. So,
well, I can't wait to read it. And folks, if you're listening to this podcast, more than likely you listen to my shows. So you have some kernel of trust to me, I guess. And I would say that I've read, a good handful of Van's books and they're always fantastic. So this is going to be great. And I cannot wait to read it. I am a little pissed at you that you're going to screw up my Goodreads reading challenge because, I said I was going to finish so many books this year and you just mentioned 104 chapters. I'm like, damn, this is going to take a while. Okay. But
I think you'll blow through it pretty quick. It's a quicker read than you might think.
So why don't we tell the listeners at home now that the Kickstarter is over, which by the way, congratulations on the successful Kickstarter.
Thank you. Thank you. So excited.
How can people people buy the book and when's it coming out?
All right. So the Kickstarter has just ended and they haven't even sent me the money yet. So I've got the books. I've got half the books sitting here getting ready to send them out to the people that jumped in early. And let me just say, by the way, this was terrifying because I've done Kickstarters for comic books where, you know, artists and I together did something. I've done Kickstarters for anthologies where like 10 other writers and an artist and I did something, or sports books where it's got a built-in audience. I had never, ever done a Kickstarter just for my own solo novels. And I did this one and another book called Union, which is not military sci-fi. And the two of them together, for them to over double what I was looking for is just absolutely humbling. I'm more excited that this did well than that the sports book did five times this, because the sports book should do five times this.
Yeah.
What if this had gotten nothing, right? So it just made me feel really good. But for people to get it, just give me a little bit more time and what I generally do with books that go on Kickstarter is I like to give the people that back the Kickstarter a little exclusivity for a while, however you say that, and to enjoy their prize. And then once a few weeks have gone by and you guys have soaked up the goodness of your prize, hopefully, then you should be able to get it on Amazon or through Barnes & Noble or whatever.
Awesome. And folks, if you follow me on social media, I will definitely be sharing out links once it's available. You should be following Van on social media as well, and you'll have a chance to get your hands on this tome of science fiction awesomeness. So I can't wait to read it, buddy.
I appreciate that so much. And all your kind words, that means a lot, man.
Well, hey, this has been a blast. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me about this little genre that I love that I had no idea there was such a bigger world of, and now I'm super excited to dive into these British books and be scared and hide under the covers with all the supernatural monsters.
That's it.
And I appreciate you sharing your passion, but why don't you tell the listeners at home where they can find more of you?
Facebook, Van Allen Plexico. There's an author page for me that doesn't get a lot of action, but if you see me in a white t-shirt, that's me. That's the page. And then on Twitter, I do a lot of stuff at Van Allen Plexico, VanAllenPlexico, at Van Allen Plexico on Twitter. That's the main place that I put out notices and alerts and talk about comics and sci-fi and stuff all day long. So come on over and join me on Twitter. And of course, I have my podcast, the White Rocket Entertainment Network, where we do various shows from Babylon 5 to James Bond. So check us out.
And folks, if you're listening to this, you're obviously a comics fan already. So if you're a fan of the Avengers in any way, shape, or fashion, of classic Avengers, Van ran AvengersAssemble.net for a zillion years. And you've got a bunch of Avengers books that are fantastic. He's a great resource for that. If you want to talk Roger Stern, oh my gosh, talk to Van. You'll have a great time. If you hate yourself and you're a fan of Auburn football, he's also into that nonsense, whatever. Not that I don't like football. I just don't like Auburn, but that's just me.
I understand. I don't like Florida State.
Fair enough. But you definitely follow Van. And you know what? Also, he's just a hell of a nice guy. So it's absolutely worth your time, folks.
Much appreciated.
Well, thank you again, Van. I really appreciate this. And I hope we find something else to talk about someday.
Oh, yeah. I'm here for it.
All right, folks. We'll come back next time where we're going to cover another topic that brings us joy. And what will that topic be? Well, sorry, folks. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Van.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive.
Find your joy.